Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we want to ask that your presence would be here one more time in session number 8. It's Thursday afternoon. We've enjoyed a good thunderstorm with hail and everything here on the campus, and we're refreshed. Pray that that same kind of refreshing will come to our hearts right now, just as we're sharing stories and illustrations, and we're talking about how to better go about sharing your word with the people around us. I pray this in your name. Amen. All right, who has completed their assignment and has yet to present it? One, two, three. Okay. All right. Now, Rob, who was here yesterday, I'm going to call him out. But I'm not there tomorrow morning. I don't have to do the assignment. Very poor student, Rob. Okay, so good. We have four people three people that need to learn. We'll do that first, and then I've got a handout. We'll start working and talking about the next thing, okay? All right. Who wants to go first?
What's your name again?
Zulu.
Very nice to have you here with us.
Thank you.
And please share again what are the important parts of the story that if you're thinking, I want to make sure that this comes out clear, because we want to know what to listen for. And then remember to encapsulate the illustration, beginning and end, and connect it with some thought that would be in your sermon.
I'm not sure if I can do that, but
okay. So you're going to tell us an answer to prayer.
Yeah, like
God stepping in.
Yeah,
kind
God
of story. Good. Okay.
Still in the business of
answering prayer. Okay, is that the point then? God is still in the business of answering prayer.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good. Lay it on us.
Okay. God is still in the business of answering prayer, and there is nothing too difficult for him to do. Several years ago, my sister and her husband were trying to have a child. After trying for a few years, they soon realized that there was a problem and they couldn't conceive. And so, like any couple, they went to see their doctor and he referred them to the specialist. Several tests later, they were told it was impossible for them to ever have a child. It was the same day that I announced to them that I was expecting my first child, that they told me the sad story. Despite of the news, prayers were continued to be offered up from friends and families. And then one day, a few months later, my brother-in-law called and my husband picked up the phone in the bedroom. I could hear him saying, "When? What? Really? Praise God! Hallelujah! This is awesome!" I was curious and went into the room. It was the longest half a minute I have ever endured, because I had to wait until he was done to tell me what was happening. "She's pregnant? Your sister's pregnant," he said. "Really?" I said, "When? What?" It was a miracle. The doctor, the specialist, they were bewildered. They couldn't explain it to them. And they wanted to see, you know, the tests and everything. And when they got everything, they took everything there, they said, indeed, it was a miracle from God. They were shocked. And there was nothing they can really add to it. They just said, this is just a miracle from God. And what I would like to say to you, my brothers and sisters, is God is still in the business of answering prayers. He is still able to do as efficiencies abundantly above all that we ask or think or desire. And there's nothing that he cannot do. So we should continue to pray, continue to trust in him. And whatever's your problems or difficulties, whatever your desires are, just bring it to the throne of grace and God will certainly do something. May not be your timing, but it's in his own timing. We'll do that for you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, that's fantastic. A great story. Now, thank you for bringing your notes up and reading it for us. Let's talk about that. Okay, all right. We're going to be talking tomorrow a bit about manuscripting, writing a manuscript and presenting the sermon from that. So you made a decision, I need to have it in front of me because it's nerve-wracking. You guys are really scary people to get up in front of. It makes us very anxious to stand up front, right? And it's hard to do. The more you do it, the easier it gets. That's good news. What's the benefit of having it written out in front of you?
I would never forget the points that I wanted to emphasize or share, because sometimes you tell a story and you forget and then you tell them.
You can make sure it's in the right order and what is said is what you want to say and you don't say what you don't want to say. That's the power of manuscripts. My preaching changed dramatically when I started writing manuscripts. Dramatically. Just because I had to think about how am I going to say this? And then I had to come back to it after I'd written it out and read through it and think about how it would sound and say, like, No, we need to do something different. It requires, it's more work up front, right? I know the story in my head, okay. Writing it out takes, it's mentally exhausting, and it's, you know, even just a story, it's hard to make sure that you get all the details. Okay, what are the cons? So the pros are, it happens just the way I want it to. What are the cons?
I bet the theory reading.
Okay, all right. Now, I bet, I don't know you, but I bet you're a good storyteller. Okay? I bet when you're hanging out with your family and friends and you're telling a story, I bet you are lively and engaging when you tell stories.
Kids brought that on, I guess.
Yes, kids are great at that because you have to with children or they're going to be asleep and you're not telling the story after all. So, whenever you have notes in front of you, there's... I told you earlier, we are always either absorbing or producing. That's just that's how we work as humans. Either we're taking information in, or we are taking and formulating information, and we are processing and pushing it out. Now, what is a sermon? Okay, when it's being preached, it must be going what direction? Now, here's the difficulty of a manuscript. Because with a manuscript, if you are reading it, in the moment, you're actually taking in what you have written, and then trying to make it go back out. Is it possible? Yes, some preachers do it very well. Dwight Nelson is a manuscript preacher. I don't know if you've seen him on 3ABN or the Hope Channel. He doesn't look like a manuscript preacher, does he? He has a manuscript, word for word, in the pulpit there.
He's one of the kids.
Okay, he is one of the kids. He,
you know, this is about 30 years ago that I first saw him on 3ABN.
Yeah, he's been in the same church for those 30 years too.
Yeah.
But he's using a manuscript. But he's using it effectively. He doesn't read his manuscript, but he has it there. Right? He's put enough work into it, he's gone over enough that he knows what's in there, but it's there. He's glancing at it, he knows what he's looking for, he's finding what he's needing from it. But then there's lots of eye contact, and there's lots, it doesn't sound like he's reading it. Is that fair to say? So that's my model, right? That's if I'm gonna be a manuscript preacher, I don't want people to know it. I don't want them to sound like I've just gotten up and I'm just looking at my notes and I'm reading. And that happens, doesn't it? And we don't ever look up at anybody, and we just read through. What's worse is sometimes you didn't do this. Sometimes we read it and we don't even understand what it's saying as we're reading it. And there is no way you can put the proper inflection and emphasis in your voice to make the sentence mean what it's supposed to mean. You understand? So when I'm communicating, I know that how to inflect the sentence, what emphasis to put on the right words in order to communicate what I'm trying to say. It's part of language. We grow up and learn how to do it instinctively. When we're reading, we don't, though. Have you ever listened to grade school kids read? Tommy kicked the ball and it went over the fence. Right? Every word has the same weight and inflection because they're taking it word at a time. You can't afford to read a sentence a word at a time when you're preaching. You can't afford to. So a manuscript is helpful when it reminds us what to keep and what not to keep, and what's happening next, what thought was going to come next. But then the thought, I can't read the thought and then reproduce it in a sermon. The thought has to already be here. Okay, now you wrote the sermon, hopefully. It is in there somewhere, right? You just need a reminder. So what I would challenge you, because you were nervous and so you were reading, you don't need the notes. Because this is a personal story.
Yeah.
You know the details better than any of us here, right? You can tell us this story without the notes, right?
So
have the notes there, that's fine.
Maybe I can read either several times so that it's just speaking.
So you've got it, you know what you're going to say. Again, part of it is being nervous. As soon as we get nervous, our brain turns off.
Yes.
It's so frustrating. I don't know why. There's a little guy in our brain. As soon as there's any kind of anxiety at all, he's like, this is it. We're out of here. Power the brain down. And then you're like, ah.
I hated that.
Yeah. It seemed so clear last night. Now I can't remember a thing I was going to say. That's why I manuscript, by the way. I know Sabbath morning I'm not going to have a clue. Now, you can write yourself notes that will remind without manuscripting. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But anyway, so thank you for bringing that up there so we can talk about how do we do it effectively. It can be done very effectively. We do need to practice it. It's got to be internal before we are safe, can safely have it up here so that it can just come out, right? Who's next?
I'm Al Clark, Stettler, Seventh Adventist Church.
Glad to have you here, Al.
I've been a member there for the last 50 years. And I've never, since I told you before, that I had preached two sermons that were accepted by the people in the church. The third sermon I preached, they started stamping the floor and said, "Let's get out of here." But I didn't know anything about preaching then. And I haven't learned very much since. But I won't start at the end of the sermon when I should be at the first of it.
Good deal.
Anyway, I thought that thing I should talk about, because I've been a medical person in the hospital. I've conducted stop smoking classes and a few other things that we go door to door, and we have a system that we use. We put some tracts in a bag and hang it on the doorknob. We call it a doorknob ministry.
Okay, good. So what's your story going to illustrate for us? What's the point?
This sermon is for those who have not got over the idea that they should have beefsteak and ham and eggs for breakfast.
Okay.
And they have continued to attend the Adventist church, but yet they never got over drinking coffee. And so my sermon that I will make up would be starting with Adam and Eve. They lived on the food that God gave them in the Garden of Eden. And of course they were put out of the Garden of Eden and began to eat whatever they could grow.
Right. And so share your illustration with us, Alan.
The illustration?
You have an illustration for us? We're doing an illustration practice here.
Well, I was going to give you the numbers of the items that I was going to bring into the sermon.
Oh, that's not what we're doing today. We don't have time for that. How are you going to illustrate? Did you have a story that you were going to share with us that would help us to understand the point of the sermon better?
Well, the problem they have is getting over coffee.
Okay.
They're addicted to coffee. Mm-hmm. And 9/10 of the world is addicted to coffee. And so, and lots of them never get over it, but that's my theme, is better living.
Okay.
And going back to the way God gave Adam and Eve food for the fruit and vegetables and nuts and whatever else God gave them at that time. And then I wanted to bring into the sermon some of the things that people want to use out of the Bible to prove it's all right to eat meat. In fact, Peter's dream about the sheets coming down. They'll use that text and say that, look at there, you can eat anything that God showed in that vision. Mm-hmm. But actually at the end of the chapter that it all illustrates there, he went with these Gentiles up to their place and into this, he was a soldier or?
A centurion.
Yeah, centurion.
Yes.
And
so that's a very interesting illustration that you're using in your sermon. If I could just pause you, let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
Because the story of Peter and the sheets being let down, you're using the illustration, and this is a term that I'm going to give you guys a handout when we're done here talking illustrations, that's going to introduce you to a term you've never heard before in your entire life, I'm confident. It's something called a contrapuntal. And what you're doing is you're allowing in your sermon the other side to have a voice.
Yes.
And that is extremely powerful. So I want to commend you of saying, some folks say this, that this, and then you tell the story about the sheet coming down, and you're allowing your opponents, even though they're not in the pulpit with you, to have a voice.
Right.
Okay, very interesting.
In the end of my sermon, I mentioned the Israelites were given a list of animals that could be used for food, the clean and unclean, and actually Noah was given the right to use some clean animals for food when he came out of the ark. But after that, their life was shortened to 120 years, and some of them had lived almost 90-some years before that. Adam, actually.
900-some years.
900-some years,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So end of the sermon should be that we should go back to being vegetarians.
For a better life and better health.
Better health.
Very good.
Anyway, I am 87 years old this year, so the rest of you are children to me. God bless you all.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I'd like to, as soon as we're done with you, we're gonna talk more a little bit about what you're doing with your sermon there. Very helpful to see that in that context. We'll talk a little more about it. But first, we've got one more illustration to share.
Don't forget you.
No, I already did.
Okay.
You take a look at
didn't raise your hand.
I'd get even for a seat.
You're next.
The point that I'd like to make with my illustration is that how often we judge people as being of little or no value, and yet they do. Everyone has value in God's eyes. And so now I start.
Sure, start. And again, just recap that for us. Remember, as that parenthetical, and it can be something as simple as everybody has value and confidence in God's eyes.
Yeah, everybody has value in God's eyes. And I remember a story that was told me when we were in Chiang Mai a few years ago, and many years ago, the Southeast Asia was all divided up into little city-states. And one city-state was the Lanna, was all little kingdoms. And the Lanna Kingdom was one, and their capital city was Chiang Mai. And one day, the king of Siam, which was in the southern part, asked the king of Lanna to come down and help him, because these city-states were always fighting against each other. And so the Lanna king took his army and went down to what is now Ayutthaya, and he helped fight in the Siam. That left the city of Chiang Mai with just women and children and a few people that were non-fighting men. And all was well. They had a walled city with gates. But one day, as they watched over the mountains, they saw a stream of people coming, and they knew that it was another city-state to the west that was coming over the mountains towards Chiang Mai city, because they wanted to capture it. And the people in Chiang Mai, they got together, what do we do? And finally the women decided, we will all cut our hair, because they wear long hair, and we'll cut it all off like men. And we will wear on men's clothes, and then we will all get up on the city wall, and as the army comes close to us, we will holler insults at them, and they will think that there's a lot of people here, and they'll turn around and go home. Well, the army came, and the women all got up on the wall, and they shouted insults at them, but the Burmese people, they were not tricked by this at all. But they were also a little bit stoic and realized that, hey, what's the challenge, what's the greatness of attacking a city with this women and children in it? And so they told us, they called one of the leaders out from the city and said, okay, we'll have a contest. Rather than having a fight, we'll just have a contest. And the contest will be this. We will go to the river, the Ping River was nearby, and we will put up a man and you put up somebody, and they both will go down underwater at the same time, and whoever can stay down under the longest, that they win the contest. And if our man stays down under the longest, then we win and you become our slaves and whatever. But if yours stays down longer, well then we'll go home and leave you alone. And so they will do this in 2 days. And so they waited the 2 days, and all this time the people of Chiang Mai, what do we do? Obviously they have a pearl diver in their troop, and pearl divers can stay down underwater for 10, 15 minutes without coming up. And so they practiced holding their breath, and nobody can stay down there that long. And finally the town drunk, he got up and he said, okay, I will do it. I will go to the contest and I will win it for Chiang Mai. I have not done much value to the city. I have been just a pain to everybody. But I will do this one thing for you. And they said, what will you do? He said, I'm not telling you what I'm doing. I just want to be able to choose where along the river that I will, that we will have the contest. And so they went out to the next day when the contest was. Everybody came out of the city and the soldiers were there, and the two men walked into the river. And the Ping River is a very muddy river, so you can't see what is anything below this much. And so they all got down, the two men went out, walked in to the river, and then they went down under. And everybody sat on, or stood on the shore waiting to see who would come up first. It was a very long time. And they waited and waited and waited and waited. And then all of a sudden, poof, a man jumped up out of the river. And it was the Burmese soldier. And he was expecting everybody to cheer, but there was no cheer. And so he came out of the river and he said, you know, why aren't you cheering for me? And the rest of his company said, well, the other man hasn't come up yet. And they waited, and he never did come up. Mm-hmm. He had chosen a place on the river where a tree was planted beside it, and the roots were exposed under the water, and so he had gone down and he tied himself to the roots of the tree so that his body would not come up, because that was the only condition. He could not come up, so he made sure that his body would not come up. And so he gave his life for the city. And so a person that was considered to be of little or no value at all to the city was actually the savior of that city.
Compelling story.
Yeah, I wish I could pull the whole thing.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Okay, very, very well told. Enough background for us to understand what's going on, because we're talking about Southeast Asia, so this is not something we're very familiar with. So you can give us a little bit of background history, which is necessary for us to understand the story. And then the salient details. Very well done. Thank you. We have one more person.
Okay, well, the reason I'm thinking you have this is because I've been struggling to find an illustration for my story. But since my husband has wrapped me, the only illustration, like my sermon, as I mentioned the other day, that I was trying to develop is how the Adventist Church treats weirdos, outcasts, and rejects. And I have been thinking about an illustration and haven't come up with one, specifically Adventist one, but the story of Norman comes to mind. And
so first of all, what are the important points of the story that you want to touch on?
How, if you truly befriend someone, you can change their lives. And they can change yours.
Okay.
Friendship is not a one-way street. In order to truly befriend someone, you have to let them change your life as well. And you have to let them matter to you profoundly as well.
Okay.
It's not enough to just fake it.
Okay. All right.
So the story of Norman, as I'm sure most of you have heard it before, is the weird old outcast that lived in the city, in the town. He was filthy. He interacted with no one. He lived in a completely run-down, broken-down house with a decrepit, weed-infested yard. And he had lived alone since his mother had passed away and just was a lonely, miserable outcast in society. And his neighbor across the street, when he moved in, he discovered that this person was living there and started reaching out to him little by little, and you know, small actions led to bigger actions, led to going in and actually scrubbing this guy with a brush to make him clean and buying him a brand new suit, not a thrift store suit, but taking him downtown and buying him the best suit he could get him, and taking him to ball games and just making him truly be part of his life, ate with him and visited with him and truly came to love him and to see in him the humanity which we all possess, the worth which we all possess in God's eyes, and became his true friend, not just a charity case friend, not just a I'm just pretending I'm your friend. And I think I would use that story as an illustration of how it should be, but not an illustration of how it is, unfortunately, in most cases.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, another case of somebody sharing with us, telling us about a story, but not telling us the story.
True.
Right? Again, this sounds like a story that's like a half-hour long story.
It's a long story.
To tell it well, right? Of a developing friendship and that. All right. Things for you to think about as you're thinking about illustrations to use. I want to suggest, if you have a half-hour long story that can't be told well in 3 minutes, but you only have 3 minutes, keep looking. Right? It's better to not do justice to a story. Just keep it on the shelf, keep digging. I'm sure you'll find plenty of good illustrations. And or just choose to preach a narrative and get up and tell the story of that one. Maybe then concluding with the text that we were looking at earlier of Jesus saying, I am Norman. Right?
Yeah.
Can you make up an illustration?
Can you make up illustrations?
Well, it's not true, but it is.
Yeah. So remember what we talked about. Illustrations can come from generic experiences that we experience in life, right? and it's something that happens. And so we can say, you know, like Gia said, a farmer went out to sow his seed. It's a generic, right? So we can set a scene and describe something taking place in order to illustrate what we're saying. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Are you ready for the next step? Oh, yes.
Can I try? I'm just coming in.
Come on. Yes. No, we are not exclusive at all. You're ready with homework.
Okay.
You're on.
I'd like to illustrate the point that even though God is invisible, you can connect with him. And last evening I attended in the youth tent, and I heard Seth Bussey give an illustration about prayer, and he talked about prayer, and the kids were all looking around. I'm like, boy, he's not connecting. God, help him connect. And at the end of it, he said, I'd like you to experience prayer. Come tomorrow morning between 7 and 8 a.m. Well, this intrigued me. I thought, is any kid going to come between 7 and 8 a.m. to pray? What? And so I said, I got to be there. Well, at 7 o'clock I woke up, and I wasn't there, obviously, so I prayed for him. Lord, help him. And I got there finally at about 7:40. And there were kids in there, and they were praying. And it just illustrated to me, sometimes you can't see God. You want to pray, you know you should pray. But when someone else invites you to pray with them, you're going to meet them. And that illustrates how you can meet God. And for me, it was a positive thing. I know what I should do. I know how prayer will benefit my life, but seeing how he reached out to the kids and showed the kids, hey, come meet with me and we'll pray together, we'll meet God together, I found that very beneficial. So it illustrated the point, and in that illustration, a girl came up to me and said, "You need some bug spray." Seemed random. Well, yeah, okay, because mosquitoes were around at that time. So I used a little bug spray, and God's kind of brought the point home. Hey, when you're praying by yourself, you meet with me. But you don't notice something else, that when you're praying with someone, they might notice about you that you need. So praying in a group helped me see the importance of something that I hadn't really realized for myself. So that, you know, God started showing me all kinds of little things relating to prayer just by getting an invitation, going to prayer where prayer was happening. And I said, isn't it important? Yes, private prayer. But if you don't know where to start, invite people to pray with you, and God will show you things you never knew about yourself.
Amen. Okay, thank you very much for sharing that. Well, let me ask you this. Okay, what was his first point?
I should have repeated it.
You had two points. Yeah. That's the problem. What's his first point? I don't know. What's his second point?
Well, praying on together.
Yeah, other people can notice things about me. But okay, what are we going to remember?
The second
point. Okay,
so I need to recap.
So you have two illustrations there. That's the secret. Which is fine, that's great, but
I should separate them. With some...
There you go. How do you separate them? How do you separate them? Can you tell them back to back?
No.
No.
Don't mix them.
Each illustration has to be encapsulated in its own parenthetical introduction conclusion. Then you can move right into the second one. That'll be fine. You just have to signal to us, we're done. And then you have to say, we're starting something new. You didn't. And because you didn't, the first point dropped off when you started the second point. They just blended together until we only had, you were talking, then you made a point. That's all we got from it, okay? Which then we should have gotten. What we should have gotten is that when we connect with God, we can invite people to connect with God, and they will, even if we don't see it or understand it, right? That can happen. So really good first point. Don't lose it by going on to the second point without recapping and making sure we understand, oh, that was the point. We can hold two ideas in our head. We can actually hold seven ideas in our head all at the same time, generally, most people. Right? We can do that. We just have to be clear on what they are. And when we're doing public communication, we have to make sure that we have repeated what they need to know and emphasize it enough that it's stuck. Then we can move on to the next one. So, very good. Thank you for sharing that. This is something that happens all the time. When I listen to preachers, I hear this all the time. They'll move from one point to the next without getting clear indication that what they were talking about is done and what they're going to talk about next is starting. Okay? Don't do that. Your congregation will thank you. They won't notice. They won't notice. They won't thank you. But you should thank yourself. They'll have no idea. All they'll know is that they understood. And then they'll follow this point. And then after this. And it was a good sermon. That's all they'll know. Right? You know, though, right? You're now learning to watch for certain things and see, oh, hey, they recap that at the end. Excellent. Okay? Very good. All right, I've got a handout for you. And this is actually what we've been talking about with illustrations. I've been pounding this home with illustrations. Now let's just take a step back and look at the entire sermon. What do we need to do for the entire sermon now? The exact same thing. Right? When you start talking about something, you have to tell people you're starting to talk about something. When you're done, you've got to let them know. So the major moves in your sermon have to be encapsulated. They have to be introduced and concluded. Okay, and that's what this is. That's part of what this handout is about. Let me hand a few back there, and hand a few back that direction, and I'll take a few back over here. Oh, here, that one back there. Thank you. Okay, and I'm going to clip this on so that you can hear a little bit better. Let's talk about the beginning of the sermon. When you walk up to the pulpit and you stand up there, the clock is ticking. You have maybe 30 seconds. And every single person in the church is going to decide whether they want to listen to you or not.
in 30 seconds. They don't do it consciously. They're not like, well, that's 30. Nothing interesting so far. We're out of here. They don't do it consciously. We are constantly making snap decisions about our life. We have to. And our brains are well equipped to do that. We just instinctively know almost immediately whether we have a connection with someone, that we like someone, that we want to spend time with them. We know almost immediately whether this is someone that we're going to want to. We call them first impressions, right? They're not necessarily accurate, but they are a huge part of how we judge someone and view someone and think about somebody. First impressions are real, and they're very influential in our own consciousness. And your first impression of a preacher is crucial. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't overcome that. What it does mean, they're going to have to work extra hard. Okay, so when you stand up in the pulpit, you've got about 30 seconds to let people know what's about to happen. If you lie to them, you're going to lose them. Okay? That means if you don't let them know what the direction that you're moving from the start, they're going to get lost. Does that make sense? How can I say this another way? When we get to church, we do not come to church thinking about what the pastor's sermon is going to be about. Correct? Right? We don't get there. Let's say I'm preaching from Judges chapter 4. My congregation doesn't get there. They don't wake up that morning thinking about Judges chapter 4 and how important it is in their life. That's not where they're at. Where are they at? Breakfast. They're at, I've got a mortgage due that I can't afford. Or my child's going off to college. Or my spouse and I had a fight. Where are they at? They're not in Judges. They're not there having done the study that you have done and thinking about what you have thought about, right? They're all over the place. So what is your job? First thing is to bring everybody together. Commonality. We need to be on the same page. And that's what you have about 30 seconds to invite people into that. And either they're going to accept your invitation or they're not. And if they don't, they're going to be flipping through the hymnal, looking in their Bible, playing on their iPhone. They're going to be doing something else because where they're at is not what's happening up front. And if you're going to be honest, you have sat through sermons that are not, you're just not with the sermon. You're just not. And maybe you've acted like you were following along because that's what good Christians do. But you just weren't there. Okay? You've got about 30 seconds to let people know, hey, we're going to be going somewhere. We're going to be doing something together. We want you to come along with us. It's a very short window. So how do you make sure that there is... The door of probation slammed shut just now. No one else coming in. Okay. All right. So if I stand up in front of my church, and let's say I'm talking about the grace of God in our lives, and I stand up and I just start talking a little bit about this and a little bit about that, and I'm not getting to the point very quickly at all. I've sent a signal, and the signal is this sermon's going to meander around for half an hour, and if you want to come along, you can get lost with us, or you can just hang out here where it's safe, right? the term on this handout is oblique. Oblique. It means it's not clear. It says the structure of moves, in the first paragraph here. Here's an example of an oblique start to a sermon. There's an old-fashioned word, a word we are hesitant to use. You will still find the word in Bibles, in hymn books, or prayers we say at church. The word is almost forgotten in daily conversation, yet the word is crucial, the word sin. The fact is, we are all sinners. I have just spent 5 sentences without mentioning what we're actually talking about today. I've talked about old-fashioned Bibles, hymn books, prayers, daily conversation, I haven't gotten to the point yet, though. Okay, you see the problem. It's oblique. What are we talking? Are we talking about? Is he talking about hymn books? Hymnals. 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 Oh, hey, hymnal. I love this hymn. And before you know it, oh, what's he talking about now? Nah, it doesn't matter. Oh, this is a nice hymn. Right? If I sing really quietly to myself, no one will hear me. Okay, that's oblique. Right? We need to be, when we begin our sermon, we need to begin our sermon. We need to get right into it. Okay? That's fair, right? The introduction of your sermon, by the way, it doesn't need to be very lengthy at all. It doesn't need to be. It needs to be, in fact, very precise and brief and short and to the point. One of my mentors, he loves introductions. And I mean, he'll look up and he'll be 20 minutes in. He'll look up and be like, "Oh, well, I need to move out of my introduction right now, and we need to get into the sermon." And everybody in the church is going, but they know him. They know the rest of the sermon's only going to be 10 minutes long. It's going to be okay. But our introductions are they need to actually do their job. And that is introduce the sermon and let us actually get to the sermon. The preacher, in the third paragraph here we're reading, the preacher has introduced a word, but that's not the topic. We're not talking about a word, we're talking about a thing, sin. And we're not even talking about the word sin, so it's very misleading, right? He's actually lying. We're not talking about a word, we're talking about sin. But he doesn't get there until enough time has passed that people have stopped tracking with him. That makes sense? The congregation may understand and make the switch, but then again, they may not. What's likely to happen is some will, some won't. Every point in the sermon is an opportunity for someone to get lost. That's why I've been so emphatic about you start it and you end it by repetition, right? By saying something similar, introducing and then concluding, connecting it, because that connection allows people to track. And if I slipped out and I wasn't paying attention along here, when I get to the end, the preacher has brought me back to, this is what we're talking about. Oh, good. Okay, I'm still, okay, I looked at the hymnal, now I'm back. Now I know where we're at. Okay?
So that's all the way through your sermon on each point. You want to do that.
Okay. Yes. Yes. So, and then this is, again, we're going to get into a little more tomorrow about kind of how to. Right now we're talking about the introduction and conclusion of the entire sermon. But if you want to think about this, so remember our garden boxes? Every major garden box needs a what? Introduction and conclusion, right? And the same rules that we're talking about here apply to each one of those major. I'm using the term move here. David Buttrick wrote a book that's about this thick called Homiletic that is... if you're having trouble sleeping at night, insomnia sets in, buy his book and just start reading it every night. And like, you know, 5 minutes later, you're asleep because it's intensely technical and you're like, I'm lost, right? Very, very intensely intelligent man. But one of the things he talks about though is that in a sermon we have what he calls moves. So not just a section, but there's something that you're doing during that time of the sermon, right? You're actually starting here and you're ending here. And each of those major moves needs to have a very clear start to it and a very clear finish to it. Okay, and the sermon itself needs that as well. So let's try this again. We need to open with our topic, but not just one sentence, right? Congregations don't follow just one sentence. We were talking about repetition before. It's crucial because when you and I are talking, I can say one sentence, you can say one sentence back, I can say, it's just how we communicate. So we can move that quick. With an entire group, we're not all going to hear it. How many of you are teachers? Any teachers in the room? Okay. It doesn't matter how you say it, some students aren't going to hear it. You can jump up on your desk and dance around while you're saying it, and there's going to be a student in the back that as soon as you're done is going to raise their hand and ask the very question you just answered. Right? It's just how we are. So we say it, and then we say it a little bit differently, and we say it in a new way until we've said it a couple of times, and then we're ready to go. Right? We're all together now. Are you following me? Everybody's understanding. So, we are all sinners. To the point, right? We are all sinners. Nowadays, the word isn't in style. We talk instead of psychological problems, phobias, complexes, neurosis. We aren't much into sin. This is better, isn't it? It starts off with sin. It ends with sin. That's helpful. The problem is, it's a little bit confusing, too. Again, what are we talking about? Are we talking about psychology? Are we talking about phobias, complexes, neurosis?
No, neurosis is sin.
Well, it's not. It's not. Yeah, we're what he's saying is we don't. Okay, this is why this is a problem right here. Is a phobia a sin? All of a sudden, you're thinking you're on a totally different track now. I've lost you. I've lost you for a few sentences, haven't I? You're trying to figure out this problem I've created. By the time you get back, I'm somewhere else, and you're like, well, what just happened there? If it's not easy to follow the speaker, our brains cry out for us to just turn them off. Right? We'll just turn it down, and we'll do something else. Okay. Let's try it again. Right? We need a block of sentences that work together to make our point. We are sinners. Sinners. The word may sound old-fashioned, but it's true. We are, all of us, sinners. Three sentences. A lot less sentences than the first try, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What if I take the same amount of time to say those three sentences as I would have given to the six or seven sentences above? How much weight is going to be on those words? A lot. There's a very powerful thing that happens when we speak and then stop speaking. Alan, are you okay? Do you need some water?
I need a cough drop.
Cough drop, good. He's got one, I think, in his pocket. I said one of the ways we can emphasize things is we can repeat it. That's happening here. Another way that we can emphasize things. It's nice music. Good. Another way we can emphasize things is that we can allow silence to put an exclamation mark either before or after it. Martin Luther King Jr. would get up to speak, and he would spend a full 10 seconds in the pulpit without saying a word. Now, I know you folks. You get up there and you want to start talking immediately. Why? Because you're nervous. I better get started. Can you imagine the agony, how painful it would be for you to stand in a pulpit for 10 seconds without saying something? But guess what? As long as you don't look terrified, as long as you look like you know what you're doing and the silence has purpose, you will fully have everybody's attention. Something huge is about to happen. That's what that says. Now, I don't know if I can pull off 10 seconds. I'm not Martin Luther King Jr. He was a preacher par excellence. I mean, his preaching literally changed the world. That's how powerful silence can be. And so, when we say less, and not that we're saying less ideas, but we're using less words and very simple. Listen to the language here. These are all very simple, easy to understand words combined in a powerful way. This might seem artificial. I write here. This might seem artificial. When I read this, it seems artificial. When I speak it correctly, it does not seem artificial. Does that make sense? When I am emphasizing it differently each time I say it, then you're getting the nuance of, okay, this is different, this is different. And it's not redundant. It's repetitive. I was going to say repetitious. I don't even know if that's a word. It's repetitive. And repetitive and redundant aren't the same thing. So avoid redundancy. Redundancy is when I don't need to say something, it's already assumed. You understand? I can't think of an example at the moment, but let's say that I say it stormed and hailed and like really just came down out there. And then I go on to describe, like to say, and there's water in the streets, and it was like everything's wet now, and I'm just going on, and I'm not actually, okay? I can say there's a hailstorm, and everybody gets the picture. They know there's the ice laying around, and there's wet everywhere, the roads are muddy. You get it. So I don't need, it'd be redundant to say that, okay? Repetition, however, for emphasis, especially at the beginning and the end of major moves, major parts of your sermon, repetition, on the other hand, lets us have clarity. All of us understand very well what has just been said, because it's important that we understand at this point. Do we repeat everything that we say in a sermon?
No.
Please don't. For the sake of the people listening to you, please don't. Only do what? The introduction, the conclusion, and anything that really needs to be emphasized there in between. You have to. You can kind of know. Anytime that you know, people need to understand it, repeat it. Okay, so what are the basic moves that can happen in a sermon? This is getting kind of technical, but I think you guys are ready for this after the week that we've spent together talking about these things. Not everything in the sermon should be the same thing. We talked a bit about this when we were talking about the garden path through the woods there that the story sermons take. You start with ambiguity, you work through analysis, and you come to this clue to resolution where you're like, oh, I look at it differently now. And then you get to see how that impacts how you view the gospel. And then where do we go from there? Right? Different things are happening at each part of the sermon. Even if it's a garden box kind of sermon where you have 4 points under a major heading, each of those 4 points doesn't do the same thing. Does that make sense? There are different things that can happen. One of them, so the first one listed here is association. One of the crucial things, this is why we use illustrations, is we need to connect the ideas of theology and the gospel with our life today. Which means the only way we have to do that is we associate something that you understand with something that you don't understand. You know, when Jesus said, I have told you about the things on earth here and you haven't believed me, how in the world are you going to ever believe about heavenly things? Right? He was trying to explain heaven in terms of earth. The kingdom of heaven is like. The kingdom of heaven is like. Well, it's like this, and it's like that, and it's like that thing over there, and it's like this thing here. Why is Jesus doing that?
Well, to give a picture. I'm trying to do the best we can.
Because eye has not seen, nor ear has heard, nor has it entered into the imaginations of the heart, what God has planned for his people. If Jesus were to come down and start talking about heaven without relating it to earth, it would have been unintelligible. They would have stoned him right away. He's insane. Let's lock him up somewhere. He's insane. Because we have to understand what we don't know in terms of what we do know. And a good sermon will always do that. Okay, that's why we've been talking about illustration. So we can associate. This is my idea, and then this is what it actually looks like, right? This is what the Bible says, but in 21st century Alberta, this is how it relates. The other side of that is disassociation. Disassociation, it means that sometimes we're going to show people a picture of something that they know, and we're going to actually say the kingdom of heaven is not like that. Right? We're going to show pictures of what's wrong, and that's okay. That's actually okay. Someone had asked, does every illustration have to be in line with what our sermon is talking about? No, not at all. It has to be in line with that move, and some moves are disassociative. Especially when we're talking about ambiguity. We're setting up a problem. I can show you all kinds of ambiguity when I look around the world. It's everywhere you look. There's injustice, and there's death, there's famine and disease, there's natural disasters. There are people simply being cruel to each other. And that's disassociative. That means that's not the gospel. It's the opposite of the gospel. And so as we look at that, we do so in terms of this isn't right. Right, this isn't right. You're talking about, like, you have people who are on the fringes of society and outcasts, and the body of Christ is walking past on the other side of the road. That's a disassociation. You see what I'm saying? That's valid. It's okay. It's okay to do that. Do we stay there? Is that where we end our sermon? No. Never. We have to bring it around to what the gospel calls for us. Okay? And now I'm going to talk about puntals and contrapuntals. This is the word that I used earlier, contrapuntals. I'm going to be honest with you, I have no idea where these words came from. None at all. I just know this is what they call it. Okay? I don't even know what it means except for how it's described here. Okay?
Musical term.
Is it a musical term? Cool. Okay. So you'd have a melody line, then you'd have something that's working at odds with that melody line. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that with me. I learned something new. That happens on a very regular basis. Cool. Okay. All right. A puntal, homiletically, in a sermon, is where we look at what is. It's what it's our idea. It's our maybe it's our homiletical idea, our sermon idea. Maybe it is it's what is true. It's what we believe. It's what we feel. It's what we understand. That's the melody line, the puntal. It's what is kind of the point and our perspective on life, our worldview. It is, if I'm going to describe things, it's my perspective on it. And it's what I want you to understand as well. So if I'm talking about whether God exists or not, I'm coming from a perspective of someone who believes that God exists. So my arguments are going to be in line with, hey, God exists. Does that make sense? And you would expect me to, that would be expected. A contrapuntal, on the other hand, is where, this is what Alan, I was mentioning to you, it's where we let somebody else who disagrees with us have a voice in what we're saying. So if I'm talking about my belief in God, I'm going to actually, for a part of my sermon, one of the moves of my sermon is going to be maybe a contrapuntal, where I say, when an atheist looks at the world, this is what she sees. Here it is. And she sees this and she sees that. She sees, and I'm trying to be as fair and honest as possible from her perspective. Does that make sense? I'm not mocking, I'm not saying, well, some stupid people don't believe in God. That's not a contrapuntal. That's an insult, and that has no place in a sermon, ever. But I can, as honestly as I can, and in good faith, say this is the problem that they see. This is why maybe they are an atheist, right? It's a contrapuntal. It means I honestly step into their shoes, look at the world from their perspective for this move in the sermon. Why would I want to do that?
Since you haven't got that person there to debate with, you set it up so you can debate yourself.
Okay. You're trying to be fair to both sides of a debate. That's a possibility. This is the biggest reason. You probably do have that person in your church. Maybe you've got someone sitting in a pew that doesn't believe in God. There's plenty of people in church that doubt God's existence. You realize that, right? Yeah, they still come because this is their community. It's their family. They're still there. You're giving them voice. You're saying, in as fair, and this is why we never say only stupid people don't believe in God. All of a sudden, you have got people in your congregation that are like, they've turned you off. They're not going to listen to another thing that you say. Because you said something untrue about them. It's not out of ignorance that they've decided they don't want God to be in existence. It's not ignorance at all, right? It's out of deep questioning and thinking deeply about things. So you want to be fair. Alan, you had talked about people who say, well, we can eat anything we want because of this vision. Okay? Be fair to that position. That's the contrapuntal. Now, does that mean I have to agree with it? No, actually, I don't agree with it. I'm on the other side. And from my perspective, but I let them have their say, and then I move on to the next section of the sermon, which is, but this is how I understand it. And I always let them have their say first, so that I can answer. Right? This is why, even though I agree that the Bible has a story about a sheep coming down with all kinds of stuff, and God said, Peter, take up and eat. I totally agree. I also totally agree with people who look around the world and they see the suffering there and they say, this doesn't jive with God being a loving God. I completely agree with them. It doesn't jive. Right? There's a disconnect. There's a problem when I look at the world and see suffering and say, God's a good God, but he created this. That's a problem. So I'm going to acknowledge that. And then I'm going to move on then to say, but even in the face of that problem, I still believe in God, and here's why. Because I see a bigger picture of who God is and the war that he's fighting in this universe and whatnot. You understand? So that's the contrapuntal. It means I don't have to get up and say, this is what I believe for 30 minutes. I don't have to. I can get up and for part of that time say, this is what the other side believes. This is what somebody else may say. This is an argument they might make. And then I can move on to it. But this is, why is that effective? One, you might have the people in your church. And if you do this well and fairly, you can speak to them. You can gain a hearing. Number two, it lets people who have never thought of that before know your neighbors might think that. It's helpful to them to understand there's people who have good reasons for what they believe on this side. And guess what? Good news is we have good reasons on our side to believe in Jesus and believe what he teaches as well. Last two things here. We should not expect every part of our sermon to look exactly the same. This is the difficulty with an essay sermon, because there's a temptation that I've got 3 points, and under each of those 3 points, I'm going to have 2 sub-points, and each of those are going to be this and this, and then I'm going to talk about this and this, and the sermon can end up looking like every step is exactly the same, and it shouldn't. There should be variety. There's not a format or a template that you can fill out for a sermon. It doesn't exist and it shouldn't exist. You don't just add in the different little words and verses into something that already exists. No, it's organic. It must grow. And every single plant is different. Every leaf on a plant is different than all of the other leaves. Maybe they're similar, but they're not exact replicas. They're different. They're on different places on the vine or the plant. They're doing different things. And every part of a sermon needs to do this. I make a note here. Vivid language and glittering imagery is tedious. The more time I spend trying to make myself sound fancy, guess what? You guys get really tired because you're having to process those big words. Speak simply. Don't try to speak like you're preaching. Try to speak like you're talking to kindergarten kids. Not that you can't ever use a big word, but just use it cautiously and try to explain it when you do. Again, it's easy for me to forget that, especially when you spend a lot of time digging into stuff and you've learned things like contrapuntals. And you're like, oh! Resist the temptation when you're preaching. Just try to use as simple as language as you can. And finally, this is important. Every move has to be about one thing. And everything inside the move has to be about that one thing. Every fact, every story, every illustration, every Bible text, everything inside each of the moves of the sermon has to be about that one thing. And the sermon as a whole has to be about one thing. Okay? So, that's right. Yeah, it has to be held together under one umbrella. Or one, there's one. So, what are we talking about in the sermon today? Whatever it is, we've got to stay on task. And every move has to help us to understand that one thing. Now, it can be a move that's pointing away from. If we're talking about the love of God, we can talk about the wrath of God. You understand? But it has to be in the context of understanding the love of God better. Right? We have to come back to the love of God. We're going to talk more about this tomorrow. We've got two more sessions to do, and we're at the point where we're talking about finishing things already. We're talking about the details of how do we write this out? What do we actually say in the sermon to get this across? This is the difficult stage, because it just takes work. Like, it takes time to sit down and think of how would I say that, and to write that down, and then how would I say the next part, and write that down, and where do the illustrations come in? What texts from Scripture am I going to be using to support this and to guide it? And how do I put it all together? And it's not easy. If it were easy, everybody would be manuscript writers, but it's not. And so usually what happens is we get to the point where we have a list of ideas, and we say, okay, I'm ready to preach. And I want to challenge you guys to do better than that, to go beyond that. It's a good place to be. And if that's all you have, you'll be okay. But you can do better than that. You can think a little more intently about how you're going to say things. I have an assignment for you for tomorrow. Okay? This is the scariest one. Maybe. We've talked about the introduction here of a sermon. I'd like for you to write an introduction for your sermon. Okay, for a sermon idea that you have. Maybe the one that you shared with us. I want you to write an introduction. I want you to look at this handout and reference it back and see how we moved from 6 or 7 sentences down to 3. I want you to do the same process. Okay, just write out your introduction the way, just in one paragraph, how would I introduce this idea? Then I want you to go back and say, how can I say this so that it is absolutely clear what we're talking about, that each sentence is supporting the next sentence, and that they're all shooting in the same direction. All right? So I know one assignment, but I guess there's a couple of stages in it. The best place to start is write out a one paragraph introduction, and then go just from what we were talking about here. Look at that and edit it. Write it first. Don't try to edit it while you're writing. Right? What we are either producing something or we are absorbing something. Okay? And when you're producing stuff, you shouldn't try to edit at that point. Just write it out. Even if it's several paragraphs or 2 pages long, just write it out. This is my introduction. Maybe even take a break from it at that point, come back a little bit later, and start asking the hard questions of, does this, okay, in the 30 seconds I have for people to understand what the sermon's about and to get on board with it, are they gonna want to? Would this be compelling? Okay, remember, less is better. Any questions or comments? Okay, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning at 10:45, and I will hear your introductions to your sermons at that point, okay?